Bom dia. Hoje, no Contraponto, vamos receber a professora Elizabeth Lowe, professora e tradutora, que vem nos falar aqui de um trabalho seu, não muito anterior à nossa entrevista, mas já com alguns anos. Trata-se da tradução da obra de João de Melo, Gente Feliz com Lágrimas, traduzida para inglês como Happy People in Tears. I want to welcome you, Professor Elizabeth Lowe. It's a pleasure to have you here today, talking about this iconic Azorian novel, one of the most important Azorian books of the 20th century. Thank you so much for being here with us and talking to our public.
Thank you very much, Irene Giammarao. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here in residence at UMass Dartmouth and to return to the Portuguese community in the New Bedford Fall River Providence Triangle. And especially, I am honored to be this semester's Elio and Amélia Pedroso Luso American Development Foundation endowed chair in Portuguese studies. It was quite a thrill to be invited. Also, to be able to work closely with Tagus Press on possibly a couple of other translation book proposals. So I'm delighted to be able to share my experience in translating João de Melo's important work with you.
The fact that this book relates to our community in terms of geographic connection, since this novel is about Azorians and Azorians in the world, right? Azorian diaspora too. I would like to ask you to start our conversation exactly by talking about the challenges that you faced while translating João de Melo's book.
Yeah, so there were a number of very big translation challenges. First of all, the unique nature of the dialect of São Miguel, where the novel takes place, at least most of it does. The terminology particular to the islands and the historical context of the Salazar dictatorship, which is the time span in which the action takes place. So the issue of language is very important because while not officially considered different languages, the difference between Portuguese dialects are mostly in phonology, some grammatical forms, and between formal and informal registers of speech. My background is Brazilian Portuguese, so I had to delve deeply into the language of the book to be able to render it appropriately in English. And the project required a good amount of research on the terms associated with the botany, ecology, economy, geography, geology, history, politics, culture, and cuisine of the archipelago. There are also considerations for the translator in rendering the polyphonic nature of the novel, which requires projecting different voices of the narrators in the book who are very different from each other, reflecting their separate life journeys. They also have different levels of education and also different gender perspectives. The polyphony also comes from the rhythms and cadences of João de Melo's highly poetic and metaphorical literary style. The title comes from the history of emigration and the sadness felt by the diaspora Azorians who leave their homeland. And this concept of sadness and happiness is very much central to the theme of the book, and capturing what is meant by that sadness is very important.
The social class or social class issues are also very important when one tries to understand this perspective about Azorianidade or being Azorian. Throughout the book, when you said that you faced many challenges, I'm sure that you had the opportunity of noticing that poverty, right? Poverty, yeah, and social inequality were major lines and the way the author organized his narrative. Since you are a specialist in South American culture, can we find common lines, common perceptions about this idea of the importance of bringing the voices of the people who didn't have enough opportunity to voice their problems? I mean, can we, and we know that João de Melo definitely is an Azorean author who knows, who read, who is very much aware and who was influenced by Latin American literature. While you were translating your experience as an academic specialized in South America, was helpful to understand this Azorean perspective?
Yes, absolutely. I see some really strong parallels between the novels of northeastern Brazil and what I encountered and that I've translated and what I encountered in João de Melo's novel, this stark contrast between poverty and wealth, the divide of privilege and poverty, and the strong effect of the land on the characters themselves, on their personalities, on their potentialities, on their development, the force of the land, the brute force of the land, and how difficult it is to yield, and how hard the labor is to cultivate the land is very much a part of that genre of novel, as it is in João de Melo. The harshness that invades the life of the characters and the different voices that speak from the land and the experience on the land. So I felt that was a really strong point of connection. And it, in fact, it did guide me a bit in recognizing and working with the polyphonic nature of the novel.
And my question obviously was not innocent, or my statements are not innocent, since one of the major problems or one of the major difficulties in making Azorean literature well-known in the United States, it has to do with the fact that people don't know much about those Atlantic dots, right?
That's correct.
It's a culture or it's a region that remains a bit unknown here in the English speaking large country, North America. And I'm saying this because it's a strategy, I think, to help Americans who are very much interested in South America to understand these other connections, these Atlantic connections. Onésimo Almeida, in the preface, right, for this translation, talks exactly about the difficulty of the Azorean writers being recognized or being known outside the islands. He says, not many Azorean writers have succeeded in breaking the sea barriers that separate them from their mainland readers, not for lack of literary quality, but because for so long the islands were practically forgotten by Portugal after they ceased to be a mandatory stop on the way back from Africa, Asia, and Brazil during the centuries that the Portuguese were crossing and controlling the sea.
Yes, and I think that's exactly right, that the Azores, the archipelago, is basically unknown to the American audience, and those who fly from U.S. to Europe don't realize what's right underneath them, and it's not that far away, actually. So, the Azores are geographically close to the U.S. and yet totally removed from it and off the American radar, in spite of more than 200 years of presence of Azorean communities in New England and California. So it's quite ironic that this literature is not better known.
Since our interview, right, is going to be listened by many Azorean Americans, right, our public, our radio is part of this Azorean community or inherited culture. I'm going to ask you to give us your perspective about why our public should reach Tagus Press, right, and get this book.
Well, This is a very important book, and few novelists like Xuanzi Miller have achieved the recognition that he has. His novel, O Meu Mundo Não É Deste Reino, My World Is Not of This Kingdom, was translated by Gregory Rabassa, the great translator of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. And Rabassa happened to also be my mentor and PhD advisor, so I studied with him as a graduate student, as did my friend Adelaide Freitas. And the book was widely read in Portugal when it appeared in 1988 and has won important literary prizes. It's also been translated into Spanish, Italian, French, Dutch, Romanian, Bulgarian, and German. So its stature in the canon of Azorean and Portuguese literature is very much established. And I believe that it is an important document that recounts Azorean experiences and the central issue of the diaspora, which has got to be part of the lives of many families who have their history rooted in that movement of people from the Azores to North America. So, as in terms of a testament to that history, in terms of the stature of the book and the beauty of it, the language, it's beautifully written. I believe that they should try to read it.
Thank you so much for inviting our public to read Happy People in Tears. And to end our conversation, I'm going to ask you to share with us one of the pages of this book, one that you think probably will convince our public to buy the book.
I'd love to read a little bit from the beginning of the book. It establishes the scene for the big family diaspora that is the saga of the narrative. And it starts with the departure of one of the three siblings who narrate, whose voices are the narrators in the novel. Her name is Maria Amélia, and as a child, she is sent away from the Azores to study in a convent, to go to school in a convent on the mainland in Lisbon. And this was typical of children of the time. Their only avenue, their only pathway to escaping the poverty of the island was to go to Lisbon and study, usually in a seminary or convent style setting. So I think this beginning of the book evokes the fear, the drama, the sadness, the emotional content of that departure, and also gives a sense of how beautifully the author describes the landscape and the seascape of the islands. And so this is from chapter one, titled Any One of Us. With the exception of their names and colors, which had faded with time, the boats remained, the same ones that Papa had decided to take her to see close up for the first time on that happy day. There they were, still, beached, hulls propped on the sand, the canvas partially covering their decks. There were the wheelhouses, the round portholes like fish eyes, and the same dried-out life preservers hanging from rusty hooks. When they left the dock and the prow cut through the blue cloth of the Atlantic heading for Lisbon, the same acidic rain was falling as it did in the evenings. Likewise, the very same cows were being herded at the loading docks, all destined for the slaughterhouses on the continents. And the wailing of the crowd of people who stood there waving hankies in gestures of goodbye soon turned into a howl that ended up mingling with the sound of the wind on the high sea. Then one after the other, they saw the island receding in the distance, the cloud-shrouded lights extinguishing little by little, wrapped in the veils of gray that fell from the sky. As the rolls of sea foam flowed in their wake, in a swath that blanketed the receding island, the volcanic range slowly sank into the horizon. On the lee side of the wind and in the electric static surging through the maritime night, the last view of the island is the image of a frightened mare's head thrashing on the crest of the ridge they call Pico da Vara. Everyone knows that it is drowning, and it does so with a noble and superior bellow. At last, the indomitable blade of the ocean sinks into the creature, and its ears suddenly still submerge. And now that the years have confused the order and intensity of the emotions of that voyage to Lisbon, the difficulty is in reconstructing the names, the shapes, the shadows of the dark forms of the boats of long ago. Even the ones that gave way to the majestic cruise ship leaves no trace. Nuno and Amelia recall the flags embroidered with nautical symbols and the enormous masts with spreaders with steel shrouds attached to the topsails. Maria Amelia, unlike her brother, especially remembers the blue and yellow smokestacks. She can still hear the sound of the boilers and feel the salt on the sticky handrails that encircled the deck, but little else comes to her. Of the bucking quarterdecks, she retains only a diffuse recollection, still and always clouded by the curse of seasickness. Whether blue, yellow, or muddy ochre eaten by rust, the colors are of little importance to her. She restricts herself to describing them disinterestedly. She doesn't want to recover that useless time, nor infect the memories that she might still retain of these or of all the other boats with bitterness. She harbors a mix of tenderness and terror for the boats. Nevertheless, she can't forget the sight of those living monuments lying in ruins, with their coiled ropes, different decks, and enormous anchors forgotten next to the small outboard engines. The guillotine-style windows of the first-class cabin bring back these memories. She peered out of them so many times in vain in the hope that someone would come to rescue her. The nuns had abandoned her in an airless cabin without portholes. A tomb-like light shone over her headrest. There were little plastic bags for seasickness arranged neatly in an abandoned ship box. There was a narrow bunk and the particular melange of smells that you can only find on boats. Saltpeter, hot tar, and the suffocating ammonia stench of the nearby latrines. Feeling an intense vertigo, she heard the cries of the cows and goats, the guttural belch of vomiting, and the continuous lament of other women coming up from the hold. And then she felt the sea humming in the vibration of the cabin walls, and like an earthquake with no beginning and no end, the Atlantic storms lifted the vessel into the air and then dropped it like an empty trunk into the valleys between the giant colliding waves. The sea did this with the same ease that long ago any one of us might be lifted by the wind to fly, not bird-like, but transformed into little winged creatures, blinded by the dust, only to land in the muddy ravines that cut through the trails of our childhood. The next minute, the convulsing seas again lifted and dropped this second arc. Terrifying craters appeared in the water, and the sea's jaws yawned to swallow the keel. An indescribable roar deafened the stone-gray night. Never had God been so distant as on those days of infinite loneliness.
Thank you so much for sharing with us a very strong passage of Happy People in Tears. Thank you for being with us here at Contrapunto, and let's hope that the future of the Azores and the Azorean culture forgets that sadness and that violence that João de Mel so well describes in this book. Thank you so much, Professor Elizabeth Lowe.
Thank you, Irene. It was a pleasure to be here with you.